This is Friday afternoon, June the 10th. I'm seated in the office of the chairman of the mathematics department, Dr. Glenn Clark. Glenn is retiring this year after a long and very fine tenure at Mount Union College, and I want to talk with him about his impressions of his training before he came here and certainly of his experiences and reminiscences during the 3 decades he was on campus. Let's start off first, Glenn, where you arrived in this world and just briefly your schooling.
Well, I was born in southern Illinois, a town called Sesic, which is a coal mining town. My dad worked in the coal mines at the time. And when I was about 3 years old, we moved to Tennessee in the county near Nashville. My dad got a job there during World War I, working for the DuPont Company at a powder plant. So I started to school in that county, and I had all my schooling through the first 9 grades there. And then we moved to Western Kentucky. By that time, my dad was a mail carrier, and he was seeing jobs with a man in Western Kentucky. So we went to Kentucky in 1929, and finished high school there, and we went to Union College, a Methodist college in Eastern Kentucky, and then after that to graduate school at the University of Kentucky, where I was a graduate assistant.
Now you did both master's and doctorate at the University of Kentucky.
Master's there in 1938 and a doctorate in 1942.
Well, just to elucidate the mysteries of mathematics, what was your special? What would you say was your specialty?
Yeah. Well, my specialty at that time was in what is called algebraic number theory. Actually, that is not an undergraduate subject in most colleges, and since I've come to my union, I've gotten more interested in certain areas where there is more undergraduate connection. So my main interest for the last 10 to 15 years has been in the area of what we call modern algebra or higher algebra. Mm-hmm. Algebraic structures in this general area.
Right.
It would be in the area of what is called algebra as opposed to geometry and analysis.
Yeah. Now let me ask you, you graduated from Kentucky then in what year?
My PhD was in 1942.
42. And you didn't arrive here until 47, so there's an interim here. And
yes.
What took place in this?
Well, in 1942, as you well know, there were things going on overseas.
Right.
And, I was drafted into the Army that summer. I went from PhD to PVT in 3 months. And so I was inducted at Fort Benson Harrison near Indianapolis. I was in the Army for about 3.5 years. By the end of the time, I was working in Washington, Virginia in the area of quick analysis, and stayed on there as a civilian for 1.5 years before coming to Ohio. It was in February of 1947 that I came to the Alliance to see about the position here.
All right, how did you match up with Mount Union College?
Well, you know, Dr. John Gross, the grand old man of Methodist Higher Education, was president of the college that I attended in Kentucky, and I would keep in touch with him over the years. He told me about 2 vacancies in the Methodist colleges, in the math department. In the spring of or winter of 46-47. One was at the Wofford College in South Carolina, and one was at Mount Union. And I went to both here for interviews. And so it was through Dr. Gross that I found there was a vacancy here, and through him, I think, probably I got some help in the way of recommendation for getting the job, because he knew Dr. Ketchum quite well.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, his wife, came from this area, I believe, in Canton.
Yes.
And so in February 47, I came for the interview, and in a few days, the job was offered, and I accepted a little less formality in those days.
I was going to say, yes, there wasn't the faculty committee, and so the selection process was probably, what, Dr. Ketchum and Dean Hyde?
Dr. Ketchum and Dean Hyde, I both talked to, and Dr. Schallenberger, who was head of the math and physics department at the time.
Yes.
And Dean Frances Fries, who was Dean of Women and also taught mathematics. Of course, she had no role probably in the decision, but she helped to orient me,
right,
about the math program. And then Ann Myers, you remember this,
right,
president in those days, and he took me to see members of the construction committee, the board of trustees.
Right.
And these are all gone now. I guess Dr. George Dean,
yes,
went to his office, Mr. Guy Allen.
Yes.
And Mrs. Hazel Watman went to their homes.
No, no, that, was that Allen instead of Allen?
It was
Walter Allen.
Jesse Bowman's brother.
Oh, it's her brother. Well, it was Guy Allen then, yeah.
I think so.
Okay.
I could be mistaken.
I didn't think he was on the board. I thought it was Walter Allen, who lived over on Vincent, but...
I think you're probably right. I think that's probably right.
I did.
Now that you mention it.
Yeah. Right. No, just for sake of the, you know, my historical bias is coming out there,
yeah,
but
right.
I think that...
Well, I'm glad to have a historian.
Yeah. Well, now, you were the mathematics department, about 90%. Who else helped out at that time, Glenn?
Well, that first year, I taught all the... two courses. Well, no, I guess Francis Fries taught about two courses each term. We were on semesters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She taught, I think, about two courses each semester, and of course, she was in the women. And that was the arrangement for several years. And when she left, a succession of people came on. Jim Rodman
right,
was with us for several years before he went on to graduate school, or back to graduate school. And we had a man named Paul Matthews.
Right.
Remember? For 7 years. Now, Paul taught full time
mm-hmm.
when he was here. And I believe it was in the summer of 56 that I went up to Canada on a vacation trip and came back right at the end of summer school to find that Paul had resigned.
Mm-hmm.
And the dean, Dean Wesley at the time, and Dr. Schallenberger were looking for a replacement. And it was that summer that Dr. Marker was employed, and of course he's been here ever since.
Right.
56.
And you have had others who have been in and out.
Yes.
And since that time.
Yes. We had two of our alumni, Barry Vogley,
right,
with us for several years, and Jim Miller, I think,
yes,
about 4 years, and Dr. Selma Moyne, who was with us 5 years,
right,
and is now in the Fringe University of Wichita, Kansas. I believe those, we had a couple of times we had people in for 1 year at a time to replace people on sabbatical leave.
Right.
Like, Dr. Orley Brown.
Yes, I remember Orley.
For a year. And then another year we had a young man named Miller in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I can't remember his first name. Now, he was here for just a year to
mm-hmm.
replace someone on leave.
Yes. But you currently have three full-time.
Three full-time now. Dr. Stinson here. And,
you want to... We'll spell that. M-I-N-E-A-R.
M-I-N-E-A-R.
Meneer. All right.
And Dr. Mark, of course, is the new chairman.
Right.
Dr. Stinson.
Do you have any part-time?
Yes. Dr. Meneer's wife teaches part-time. She's been teaching one course per term this
mm-hmm.
year. She has all of her graduate work for PhD except the dissertation, so she's certainly
mm-hmm.
well qualified.
Yes.
Ideas.
Right. What would you, in reflection, what would you say is the great change that's taken place in teaching mathematics, or does two and two always make four?
Well, I guess there have been more well-known changes in the public schools than there have been in the colleges, because the general public is more aware of this, having
mm-hmm.
children in the public schools, and be more in the press about it. But in the colleges, I think the chief change has been that material which was formerly taught at a higher level in graduate schools has come down as an undergraduate subject, so that I'm teaching now things that I did not have until I was in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this is part of the same process that has pushed down into the high school subject that used to be taught in college, like some calculus and
yes.
matrix theory and things of this kind. So in general, it's been, in a sense, a toughening up the
mm-hmm.
curriculum of subjects
do you think,
taught at a higher level.
Do you think the Sputnik and computer maybe have been mainly responsible?
No, I really doubt. I think that probably had a lot to do with the public schools beefing up their
mm-hmm.
programs. And so in a way, this may have affected the colleges because they were getting better prepared students
yes.
who could handle these better subjects. But I think in part it's been due to the expansion of the subject of mathematics itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has been a lot of interesting subject matter to teach, which we formerly thought was suitable only for graduate school, but we had some people work on good textbooks and exposition at a level where it can be handled in, at the undergraduate level.
Right.
So that's part of it, too.
Yes. Well, now, when you arrived on campus, there were no faculty apartments, but there was a spatial quarters awaiting you on this campus. You want to...
Well, yes. After I talked to Dr. Ketchum by phone, he agreed upon the arrangements, and he called me then still later and said there should be a new boys' dorm on the campus, and I wanted to know if I'd be interested in being a resident. So I said yes, I thought I would. Well, it turned out then I took that position as head resident of East Hall, which was opened in the fall of 1947. It was opened a month after school started, and the first month, the boys who were assigned here spent their time in Memorial Hall to put up double-decker bunks on the floor of the gym there. And it was not entirely satisfactory, but managed to survive until around the middle of October, we all moved into East Hall then. During that time, I had a room in a house nearby. I wasn't living in the gym myself.
Yes.
Yeah. But I... had the head residence supporters here in East Hall, where now Dr. Markley has his office.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said the boys managed to survive. How did you manage to survive then after you became the...
Well, it was not the happiest situation because of the close quarters. We had 52 boys here on this one floor, four in the room, two double-decker bunks mm-hmm. in the room. And the walls are not exactly soundproof.
Yes.
So it was kind of a noisy time, but I was younger then, and I could take it pretty
well.
I wouldn't have lasted the year now. That kind of situation.
Well, now, in the basement, was maintenance. Did they have a place down there?
Well, they had a place in the north end.
Yes.
But the east, the south end, rather, had two classrooms.
Right. Is that economics?
Economics at those
yes.
classrooms. Well, in fact, the math classes, some math classes were held down there. I taught mathematics and finance and algebra and I don't know how many different courses. At that time, of course, we didn't have Wilson Hall, and we had some classes in math that were too large for the old observatory, which was a regular math class.
Right.
So we had to have some of them down in the basement of East Hall.
Then for many years, your central teaching spot was Clark Observatory.
Oh, yes.
It was Dr. Clark at Clark Observatory.
Yeah. Yes, it was Dr. George Washington Clark.
George Washington Clark, yes.
Right. That was the main place. In fact, I had the only office I had was in the classroom over there. From 1947 up until Wilson Hall was built, and I believe I moved in over there in 1957 or 58.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the main math classroom building
right.
for many years.
Yes. Then you were at Wilson Hall for how long?
I think it was around 1968 that we moved over here. The math department offices moved over here
right.
from Wilson Hall. I believe it was 68. But the physics department had grown by that time and really needed the space.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had nice spacious offices over here.
And of course, as the dormitory accommodations for both men and women increased, it took the pressure off of this for dormitory space.
Yes. After I was here, it had been at different times the girls' dorm and the
right.
boys' dorm. But as you say, with the new dormitory facilities, then this was released.
Right.
And the rooms which had been used for students were remodeled. Well, there wasn't so much remodeling, it just took out some partitions
mm-hmm.
and made classrooms, and then some of the rooms, like my office here, were untouched. This room was one of the rooms in the
yes.
dormitory, and so was Dr. Meniere's, and so was Dr. Murphy's. So we just took out some partitions to make space large enough
mm-hmm.
for classrooms.
Right.
That's all we've done.
Yeah.
Done some relighting to make the
yes.
More
right. Well, going back to your first visit on campus here, first associations, many people found President Ketchum to be a little austere and reserved. Did you find that, or did he come through a little more warmth with you, or what was your relationship?
Well, I didn't sure that he was austere or reserved. He was not unduly effusive, but I didn't detect any reserve particularly. I thought our relationship was maybe what was proper for people who just met, you know.
Right.
And he was always very kind to me all the time I was here, and so was Dean Hyde. And although Dean Hyde left about 2 years after I came,
right.
Of course, Dr. Kelson died in
my
fifth year.
Yes.
Yeah. And because I was a junior, very much a junior faculty member all the time they were here.
Yes.
But they were both very kind to me, and I treasure the short association I did have with them. Somewhat longer with Dr. Ketchum.
Yes. And of course, you have known Lucille Ketchum over the years, then, because she was back. And in many respects, that if Charles did seem reserved, Lucille more than made up for that.
we've had a very nice relationship over the years, and I had the pleasure and privilege of presenting her for her honorary doctorate degree a few years ago at commencement. And I was very pleased to get to do that.
Right. Do you think offhand of some individuals who stand out in one way or another? The students would say they're characters, faculty members. Sometimes faculty don't look at them quite that way, but have you had some associations with individuals? I think, for example, someone like Jack Coutts was here for a while and then left, but over the years, have there been some that stand out like that?
Well, of course, Bill Rice and I came the same year, and Bill was known, I guess, somewhat as a bit of a character on the campus, and Bill and I have been good friends ever since that fall of 47 when we first met. Some of the ones that I didn't know so well, who were what you might call characters, I suppose, but unusual. One was DeVos.
Oh, yes, in sociology. Yes.
I don't know. I can't think of, I guess my memory is not as good as it used to be. I don't think of any others along that line who were sort of oddballs. There were some who were sort of unconventional, perhaps, like the Funos.
Yes.
I wouldn't say unconventional exactly, but very interesting, and she is an artist. And
right.
Spent some time in England.
Well, we'd say they have a different lifestyle today,
right.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a phrase to use.
Right.
Yeah.
What about others, perhaps, that you've had a closer association with? Some of those who have left, or?
Of course, you mentioned Jack Coutts,
whom
I did know for several years, and we were both bachelors and ate together at the College Inn a lot, and I went away on sabbatical one year and came back and found that he had gone.
Yes.
Another one that I liked over the years was Eric Johansson, who was in the art department. And of course, the old timers who were actually the backbone of the faculty when I came in their middle years. But influenced the faculty a great deal, and I was privileged to get to know most of them quite well, fairly well at least. Dr. Schallenberger, of course, Omarino, Eric Eckler, Ruth Appenhagen, Mary Eckler, and of course, your mentor, Robert Stauffer.
Yes, and Bill.
Still living at
Bill Morgan.
Bill Morgan,
yes.
And I may have left out some, but.
No, I think that covered pretty well. Of course, I suppose you knew Kitsy, too.
Oh, yes. I was just thinking the other evening when I was at a dinner with Mrs. Kitzmiller, thinking back to my first year here, how they both befriended me, and at the first faculty reception for freshmen, which used to be held in Morgan Gym, and quite a formidable long
line
for the freshmen to come around. I was standing by the Kitzmillers, and they helped me with my first reception, and I didn't know anybody, and of course they knew a lot of the parents of these students and so on.
Right.
And were pillars in our church, and were always very nice to me. Yeah.
Well, I think, I was talking to Mrs. Kitzmiller yesterday, that's the old McMaster concept of the big happy family. And it wasn't such a big family, and that sometimes it wasn't quite so happy, but I think there are some characteristics of that we miss today, and I think it's too bad the passing of that. Kitsy, for example, befriended so many young people who came to the campus and made him feel at home, and it's just a different lifestyle today.
Well, that's right. I remember in the fall, the first fall I was here, I believe, the president had a reception at his home. It wasn't formal enough for you to call it a reception. It was called a faculty party.
Yes.
At which slides were shown of the previous summer's picnic up at
Brownhaven
on the lake.
Yes.
Well, we used to have those every summer.
Right.
But now, as you say, that was an era, I guess, which passed, although it was pleasant at the time.
Yes.
And I think it's true. It was something nice that we had come from us.
Yes. I suppose you gained another respect, perhaps, but it's too bad some of those traditions have had to be abandoned on that. Well, you mentioned about eating at the College Inn, and I suppose you're the champion of the faculty for years eating there. Would you want to estimate how many years, probably? I used to go by and used to be a fixture to see Dr. Clark in there at the table in the evening.
I'd have to know when it closed. I'm not sure what year that was, but I would think up until I went on my sabbatical in 1969. I believe it was still open at that time.
Mm-hmm.
For 22 years maybe,
yes,
that was more or less my regular eating place, although I, in those days, ate out most of the time except for breakfast. And so I would go around other places for variety. That was my main place, and place the Hawkins over there were good friends, and the Tipper Academy. It was a great place to eat, and the social center, too.
Right, it was. I was talking with Ray Deal. He mentioned, of course, about the coffee time in the morning, and the College Inn was one of the meeting places. This, again, it was a very nice custom. It matched different faculty people together, and students had an opportunity to have a little social give and take, and it's something we miss now.
Right, and another place that was popular for the coffee hour was Ren's Diner.
Right,
on State
the
Street.
Diner.
And that was close to the administration building, and so it wasn't only the faculty and students, but the president and the dean would be in there too.
Right.
I remember especially the Bracey era, and Dean Wesley was here, and so on. Quite common to see him in there.
You mentioned Jack Coutts, and you ate with him. I can think of another, Harold Gilmer.
Oh, yes.
That you, who was in classics here for a few years.
Yes, he was. He was
who were your other partners there? Can you remember any others?
Well, of course, after the tragic death of Omar Ingalls' wife, first wife, he would eat dinner over there. So I would eat with him for probably a couple of years that went on. I'm not quite sure at that time. There weren't any other faculty that I recall who ate regularly over there. There were some younger fellows like David Collin, who was now the head of the math department at the high school, who was married then, and we got acquainted over there. Don Wilkinson, who used to be a student there, an announcer.
Yes, right, the WFAH.
He was one of our regulars for a while. And I think by the time it closed, those people had left, and Dave had gotten married, and a lot of the evenings I would have dinner with no one except the Alliance Review to keep me going.
I see. You outlasted them all.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, I should have mentioned among the prominent faculty members that I liked and respected was Pat Engelbert.
Oh, yes.
Who has been gone from town for so long, but he was I think one of the most highly respected members of the faculty during the time he was here.
Right.
It was a great loss to the college, I think, since he left.
Well, now, you were, of course, kept very busy in the classroom, and you've been active on many campus committees, but you're also active in the Union Avenue Methodist, now United Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to indicate how you attended there? You didn't go to the Vine Street, or it wasn't the Vine Street Methodist, or down to First Church. How did you happen to go to Union Avenue?
I suppose it was primarily because it was so close. And at that time, as we mentioned earlier, I was the head resident here in East Hall, and it was just across the track, and I didn't have a car in those days.
Yes.
So it was partly a matter of convenience, and I suppose, come to think of it, there was another reason. When I first arrived in Alliance in the fall of 1947. Dean Hyde met me at the train station. He knew that I was to be head resident of East Hall, and it was not yet finished, and he had a room arranged for me, so he met me there to take me to my room, which was on State Street, just west of the Methodist Parsonage. Mm-hmm. And before he got to the room, he saw the minister's wife in the yard, and stopped to introduce me to her. She was the choir director at this church, and before I got to my room, I had agreed to join the choir. So that was, I guess, the real reason, come to think of it, that I got started over here.
Right. And, of course, with the exception of your sabbaticals and perhaps a few odd Sundays, you have sung in the choir since that time,
yes,
right?
Yes, I've sung in it ever since that time, which would mean, I guess, 27 years, counting the 3 years
right.
I was on sabbatical.
Right. And in addition to that, you've carried quite a load at the church, in the both in Sunday school and in church offices as well.
Yes, I've taught Sunday school there most of the years that I've been here. You mentioned Mrs. Kitzmiller a while ago. She was the one who talked to me soon after I came to Alliance and asked me to teach a class, a college class it was. And that began my teaching, and I've taught two or three other classes since then, including one that you had taught for many years. And so I was in the teaching part of the program, and also at various offices, and followed me as lay leader in 1958,
right.
At that time. And so I had several offices there.
And but not only there, but on the district and conference level as well.
Well, yes, I was district lay leader for 4 years.
Right.
When I went on sabbatical in 1969, I gave that up. And I was on the conference board of lay activities, or conference board of the laity, as it's now called,
yeah.
For several years. And in 1960 was a delegate to the jurisdictional conference.
Mm-hmm.
At the time.
And during these times, in the summer and on sabbaticals, you have traveled quite extensively abroad in all parts of the world. There's an interesting story about Dr. Isaac Taylor Hedham, whom you never knew, but have probably heard stories about. But Dr. Hedham was a missionary in China, and he traveled around and on Chautauqua tour. He'd been all over the United States. But he used to make speeches to the student body, and he had a very incisive manner of speaking, and he would say, Mount Union College is the finest college in the whole world. And he used to talk about when he was a student coming here, seeing the dome of Chapman Hall, and thinking how it was almost like St. Peter's, and I think in a sense that people like you, and you're talking about some of these earlier faculty, you've traveled and you've seen all this, and yet you come back and have a great sense of commitment to this college. And so you must have this, share this sort of feeling that Dr. Hedham expressed.
Well, yes, I'm realistic enough to think that Mount is perhaps not the finest.
Well, yes, so that was kind of a hyperbole,
college,
yes.
But I do think it's a fine college, or I wouldn't have stayed here as
right.
long. And I went to a college like this, smaller than this, myself as an undergraduate, and when I began to think about my life's work even before I went to college. I wanted to go into teaching. At that time, I thought I would go into high school teaching first. But as time went on, people encouraged me to go into graduate school and try for college teaching. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I wanted to do things anyway. And I never really had any serious thoughts about doing anything other than teaching. And during my later college days, my thoughts were teaching in a college like this, which I had never heard of Mount Union at that
right.
time, but it was, for me at least, a very happy meeting when I did come here and found a place to my liking, and
mm-hmm.
it's been a place where I've been able to devote whatever talents I have and feel that it's something worthwhile.
Well, I think it's a very fine contribution, certainly the testimonials in the last few weeks should convince you, give you some satisfaction in that respect,
well,
Glenn.
People have been very
yes. Happy. Well, this is one of those hard questions to answer, but in 47 and 77, What are the great changes? You think in the student body, in the faculty? Do you notice? Do you want to comment on that?
Well, first of all, I might mention the physical plans, which you didn't mention, but
yes.
That's an obvious one, which you're all well aware of, and it's not the most significant, except that it indicates that there's been a period of very considerable growth
right.
and expansion in the college. But as far as people are concerned, of course, there's been a great change in the personnel on the faculty. It's been almost a complete turnover.
Yes.
There are, I think, four people, three besides myself, who are on the faculty now. They were 19. And I was thinking in the faculty meeting this morning, looking around and seeing how many young people there were, sort of looked like in their 30s maybe.
Yes.
And you can see that there has been a considerable change in this time. I think one change in the faculty role that I am pleased about is the increasing degree to which the faculty is in charge of its own affairs.
Mm-hmm.
We have now a committee on faculty which assists in all the personnel decisions and makes recommendations. We have a faculty constitution which we didn't used to have.
Mm-hmm.
We have
All right, now continue with the Constitution you're commenting.
The faculty Constitution provides for a written agenda before each faculty meeting, two or three days in advance. It requires that minutes be distributed to all the faculty members, whereas there used to be just one copy kept
yes.
by the dean. It requires that there be written reports by each committee following its meeting. And in these ways, And some of the most important committees are elected. This is required by the Constitution.
Yes.
So I think in these various ways, the faculty has gained control of the events over which mm-hmm. it normally should have jurisdiction. And we have faculty representatives on the Board of Trustees, not voting members, but mm-hmm. observers. And the sabbatical leave program is another thing which I think is great
yes.
to help the faculty. So the enhanced role of the faculty in the college, I think, is one of the positive things I've seen, mm-hmm. and I think it's a very good thing.
I came back a few years before you did,
yeah.
and my first year there was a standing rule, a tradition, that a faculty member, and this didn't matter whether he had a PhD and had come from a chairmanship of another campus, he did not speak the first year on
mm-hmm.
issues.
Oh, yeah.
He remained silent and observed, and then the second year he could get up and speak.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can imagine a rule like that today, even a tradition would
yeah.
be anathema.
Well, I wasn't aware it was an unwritten rule, but I did observe it
yes.
my first year or two. It might be hard to believe in recent years.
Well, that went out with the war, along
yeah.
with the smoking
yeah.
and many other
yeah.
Restrictions like that on
yeah.
campus.
I think as far as the student body is concerned, we've seen the same changes here that have been going on around
mm-hmm.
the country. There was kind of a conservative period, I guess, during the 50s, and then we were affected by the activism of the 60s, especially the
mm-hmm.
late 60s.
Yes.
Of course, Kent State being not far from here, we were affected by the incidents there in the spring of 1970.
Right.
So I understand, although I was on sabbatical that year myself
mm-hmm.
in Georgia. And I think the chief thing as far as this everyday student living is concerned is the amount of permissiveness, if that's the right word, which we have on campus now in terms of dormitory hours and alcohol, this kind of thing, and dress.
Yes.
Classroom dress is quite a bit different from what it used to be.
Right.
And for myself, I'm just old-fashioned enough, I guess, to think that we have lost something when we have removed some of the niceties of life in this
right.
city. I'd rather see people come to class, you know, properly dressed. Not that they learn anymore, but it's just, I think, one of the ways we used to do things that we don't do them anymore.
Right.
I liked it the way we did it before.
It's a little better fringe benefit.
Yeah, right.
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 Yes.
Yeah.
No, I think this is true. I was commenting with Ray Deal, who, of course, was a student here back in the 20s and then dropped out and then came back after the war in the GI Bill.
Yeah, he was in one of my classes.
Right, yeah, this is that's interesting. Well, of course, his son, and he entered as freshman.
Yeah, right.
But in Chapman Hall, when you came in from the west there, the women went up the right side and the men went up the left side, and you just didn't violate that, and freshmen came in the back. You know, but today, students just wouldn't hear of a tradition like this, and yet everyone thought this was just a great tradition, and the people come back and comment about it.
Yeah.
As you say, well, I quoted with Ray the Bracey's comment, the period, President Bracey, at about the time he left, said we're going through a period of transition from tradition, and some of us old timers just can't figure out quite where we're what the tradition is now. This is a difficulty. On that. So, well, your plans now, when you leave here after commencement, are to go back south again, right?
Yes, going back to Western Kentucky, Mayfield, Kentucky.
Well, speaking of the marshal, this is one thing I overlooked. You had a go at that for a while, too, didn't you, Glenn?
Yeah, I was the college marshal, I think, for 3 years. And this was from about 60, 69, I think. And before that time, I followed, before that time, there had been three marshals who had the job for quite a long time. Of course, Bill Morgan, I guess, has a record of 25 years.
Yes.
And then Jack Rachel had it for quite a while.
Yes.
And then Ray Deal
had
it for, I don't know, I think maybe 8 or 10 years.
Right.
So Dean Bernie Gross, the dean at the time, and Dr. Bracey asked me to do it. And so I agreed to do it. I don't think it's one of the kind of things I can best, but I was willing to do my part. And so I had it for 3 years. I think one of the things that I accomplished there maybe was to divide the labor somewhat. It used to be that the marshal would order robes for the faculty members who had to rent robes, would have responsibility for the printing program, had to go down to the lines review and reproof on that. So I got the dean and the president to divide the labors and have the business office take care of winning the robes. I thought this was their role. And have the public relations office handle the printing of the program. I thought this was their role. We tried to divide the work so that it wasn't quite so much work for the marshal.
Right.
And have the appropriate people doing the appropriate jobs.
Yeah.
So I guess at least I accomplished that much for the future marshals.
Well, I think that's an accomplishment in itself. And during the time that you've been here, you've lived within, almost within walking distance, haven't
yes,
you,
I
of
have.
The campus?
Yes, all the time. I always wanted to be fairly close. I was right here in East Hall for 1 year, and then...
All right, we're talking about you. You came here, and you lived at East Hall, and then from there, your quarters, your living quarters were...
Well, I lived down... on Hartshorn, just across the Lambton Nursery for a year. I just had a one room rented there upstairs.
And who did you stay with? Who had that,
that
place?
That was Mrs. Hart, I believe. Mrs.
Yes.
Lawrence Hart, if
right.
I remember rightly.
Yes.
And then from there I went to Miller Avenue, South Miller Avenue, where I rented the old upstairs at the house of Mrs. Bertha Soul.
Yes.
His son taught here back in the 30s.
Right, taught religion here. Yes.
And I lived there until after her death, which was, I believe she died on Thanksgiving night in 1959. And so I stayed on there until school was out the following spring. And then I had her room over at the corner of Cherry and Mill for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went on sabbatical in 1962-63. And when I came back from the sabbatical, after a summer spending in the college houses here on Hartshorn Street, then I moved in with Chauncey Schuster down on the South Rock Hill in the fall of 63, and I've been down there ever since 14 years.
Of course, years ago, whenever I first came here, practically all the faculty lived within walking distance. Mm-hmm. I think Dr. Cribbs in the history department, who lived out on East Beach, was the only person who lived any great distance. Everyone else was within reasonable walking distance.
Well, I've preferred to be this close
yes.
because I can go home at lunchtime right. and we have a lot of bad weather here, and I don't like to drive in bad weather. Yeah. And if it gets too bad, I just leave the car and walk. And see,
yes.
and, so it's been very convenient, mm-hmm. to say the least.
You never took up a bicycle.
No, I may do that later, but if the energy situation gets right. worse, but I've never, I can ride a bicycle,
yes.
but I just never use it as a mode of transportation.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, I think we've covered pretty well many aspects of the years here. As I mentioned before we started, I'm sure when I leave, you'll think of two or three things that you want to put on. Of course, you always have that option if you'd like. But I appreciate your time and your interest in doing this, Glenn.
Well, I'm very happy to do it, and if it adds anything to the archives, I'm pleased to be a part of it.
Okay, thank you.